Coach, are you still hanging on to that old shooting machine that's just sitting in storage and not getting used at all? Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help trade in your machine. Any make, any model, in any condition, even if it's from a competitor. Plus, you get an extra $250 off the Dr. Dish commercial lineup when you mention Rising Coaches.
The biggest thing for me, I think every kid could be a leader, and I think every kid could be resilient. They just haven't had the opportunity yet.
On this episode of the Rising Coaches podcast, we're joined by John Carroll, basketball architect at Newman School and director of basketball at Masters Academy. Coach Carroll has worn many hats throughout his career, including athletic director roles, work as a TV and radio basketball analyst for ESPN, serving as an advanced scout for the LA Sparks, and leading JC Advisors LLC as a liberator of talent. He also spent time as a head coach at Northfield Mount Hermon, helping build strong programs on and off the court. In this episode, we discuss how to build culture as a new head coach, while still holding academics to a high standard, ways coaches can help develop leadership within their players, and some offensive and defensive staples he believes every strong program should have.
Welcome back, everybody. The Rising Coaches podcast here with another episode. Your hosts, Alan and Doug. Today, we're excited about this one. We have the, and bear with me here, I know he's got a lot of things on his plate, the director of basketball for and basketball architect, Newman School, and the director of basketball at Masters Academy. Ladies and gentlemen, John Carroll. Coach Carroll, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm pumped to be here. This is great.
Yeah, thank you, man. We really appreciate it.
For sure.
So first off, the first thing I want to dive into is there's two things I want to dive into. We discussed it a little bit before here, but okay, if you look behind me, there's a jersey hanging up, and it has your name patented all over it, John Carroll University. So the number one thing is I want to say thank you for my experiences that I had in college. I know there's, in reality, no correlation, but great times.
I was going to thank you for representing my school so well. So doing so many tournaments, all conference. I want to thank you for carrying the name in a really great way.
Of course, of course. I'm honored. And the second thing, though, is the amount of things that you have done in this realm it's impressive, right? And I'm just going to go over and name a handful of them, being an athletic director of youth camps, head coach, consultant, basketball analyst for ESPN, lecturer, advanced scout, basketball architect, as we mentioned, which is one of the greatest names that I have heard. I love that so much, so I'm going to give more props there. But the one thing that I've noticed is you've spent most of your career along the prep life, right? I'm sure there was a lot of opportunity for growth and to move up and evolve in the business. But what originally drew you towards the prep life? Because obviously this is something that is meaningful to you and stands out a ton, and there's been a lot of success in it. So what kind of drew you to the prep life of basketball?
When I first started reflecting on my own career when I was as a player, the level that impacted me the most personally, academically, socially, basketball-wise, was prep school. So when I was thinking about returning to coaching or not getting into coaching, that really had a lot of impact. And then specifically, the school really changed my life. So I really wanted to go back to honor the school that changed my life. And every single day I worked, I was like, I'm paying homage to what the school did for me. My brother went to school there a year after me. And that was the inspiration, was like, What impacted me the most, it wasn't college, it wasn't high school, it was really my 1 year at prep school. And then this particular school really impacted me. And then I settled in because I thought I had a lot of impact, and there's a lot of ability to really help kids in that age group, 16 to 20. And I think in 20 to 24, they're really doing their own thing, and it's tough to manage them and kind of conspire and do all that, I think. But the 16 to 20, I remember what it was like to be 16 to 20 still. And I never forgot it. And I thought I could really, it was really my sweet spot. So the inspiration was how it changed my life. And then I just figured out that this is really the place that I should be, where I can really impact.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Number one, if you've been in the advanced scout before, congratulations for still having your sanity, because that's a different world and a different life. But in that 16 to 20 age range, what did you find consistently that, what was the number one thing that kids needed the most when they got, because they're kind of crossing the bridge, right? It's not really high school, but they're not in college yet. And so it's almost like a it's another bridge to cross before they're trying to get where they want to go, as opposed to going directly from high school. But what was the, I guess it's not, it's probably hard to put it on one thing, but what were maybe a few things that just consistently you're saying, by the time they leave here, we've got to make sure this gets done?
Yeah, so I think we all have our core beliefs and what we're trying to accomplish. And this really talks about basketball too. It was early in my career, it was shocking how inconsistent kids were in level of preparation for what we're doing. So initially I'd be like, oh my God, you've never done a shell drill. Holy moly, you don't have a set of screen. And it was like the ambitious part of me was like, I would love to get a place where a kid is in second grade in Boston and moves to San Diego, and that third grade coach knows what to expect because there's actually a curriculum in the United States, right? Mm. So the same mm-hmm. thing applies to their development as people. You just don't know what they've experienced, but you know what they need to have in order to be prepared for college. So my sweet spot really was studying what success looked like in college and then getting them ready for that. We all have limitations, and I don't know how good of a coach I would be coaching in college, where for some kids, there's no more basketball afterwards. So I love the fact that I'm coaching kids that always have more basketball to play. Every single kid I've coached in 25 years has gone on to play in college. So having that carrot and having that motivation to be prepared was something that really gave me a lot of authority in terms of helping, you know, shape them. The biggest thing for me, I think every kid could be a leader, and I think every kid could be resilient. They just haven't had the opportunity yet. So for example, on the leadership part, we wouldn't call our kids upperclassmen and underclassmen. We call them leaders and young leaders, right? So the expectation is that you're going to learn to lead here. And the other part is these kids don't have as much opportunity to learn resiliency that I did when I was a kid. Like every single day I came back home, was like, oh my God, today was crazy. I had to learn so much. And these is out there on my own running around New York City. And these kids have just fewer opportunities for that. We wanted to create like a resiliency training academy where they get to college. Everything was repetition and very little, if any, was introduction. But those were like the real motivations.
Yeah. No, I love it.
How do you instill, because you said that everybody can be a leader, and I completely agree with that. Everybody has, I feel, the qualities to be able to do it. Some obviously more than others are born with it more. It's something that just needs to be taught, and especially the hard work gene, right? Like people say, oh, this kid works harder. Yeah, there's some kids that are just naturally work harder, and I feel like they've learned it maybe seeing their parents as they grew up or whatever it might be. But going back to what you were saying about, okay, the leadership, how do you help instill that into your guys then?
I think the first part is you got to demonstrate it yourself and how you live and how you talk. And there's I've been to a lot of college campuses and watched practices. Every one of them says attention to detail, and maybe seven of them do it, like truly do it. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
So it's the same thing. It's if you're expecting them to be leaders and then you slip and you slide and you are inconsistent and you don't tell the truth. And that's first, right? And then the second part is that leadership doesn't look one way. In 2010, I had three really great leaders. One was a great leader by example. One was great leader through hard work. And the other one was just a superhero who could do all things. Each one of them was different. And I think having kids understand that you don't have to be in people's faces and gregarious and animated. You could do the Tim Duncan style of leadership too. And I think The Captain Class is a great book that I give to all the kids that are really exploring leadership. And in it, they have 11 different styles of leadership. And I think when kids understand that leadership doesn't have to look one way, it really opens up the opportunity for that to be there. And then in terms of the program, I want kids to lead in their categories. If you're the best practice player, I want you to do that. If you're the best communicator, I want you to do that. There's so many opportunities for leadership and categories that you could win. And I want them to compete in a category where they feel ownership and authority over that spot in our program. So you'll see leadership pop up all over the place in our program.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. The fact that they know there's different ways to do it, one that empowers them because that's where you kind of get the point of, yeah, I can do that too. But it also eliminates that ceiling of if you're not doing it this way, then you're not leading. Some people, not Kevin Durant, because he's not the vocal guy and all that. But if you've seen him work, like I went to a USA workout one time, USA basketball, And if you just watch the way his approach bleeds leadership, just because of his work ethic and his style, and the guy is ultra uber consistent in terms of how he carries himself. So I love the fact that you empower them, that there are different ways to do it. And you're teaching them to lead themselves first, right? Because you're not leading anybody else until you lead yourself.
Yeah, because one example is like we script the first three plays of the game, and then we let the point guard pick plays after that. And that's an opportunity to lead. The jersey number one is our culture carrier. That's an opportunity to lead. Then we have captains. The captain doesn't have to be our culture carrier. That's an opportunity to lead. So I just think all that's really important. And then the lesson that's the biggest for kids often is the kids who do consider themselves leader, it's okay, who's following you? So I had six seniors, this is 2022, I had six seniors, they all consider themselves leaders. And then I was like, okay, who follows you guys? And then two of them pointed to each other. I'm like, wait a minute, that doesn't work.
That's right.
You're consider yourself a leader and that guy's following you.
But buddy system doesn't count with this.
Yeah, it doesn't work. So that's the biggest piece. And then you talk to kids about, they go to the gym, it's like, all right, who are you bringing with you? And there's all kinds of opportunities to lead, but you got to get followers. You aren't a leader if no one's following you. So I think that's often a shock to kids where they really have to ponder and like really be thoughtful about, okay, wait a minute, I am not creating followers. I'm just demanding a certain way it should be done and no one's paying attention to me. So I got to make an adjustment. And I think that's important for these, especially this age group, to learn. They got to pivot and be thoughtful and be like, okay, well, let me audit what's happening right now.
Yeah, for sure. And they may be following you, but are they following you for the wrong reasons?
That's right. That's right. There's that leadership for sure.
You could get followers the other way too.
No question.
Yeah, bad tendencies or leading them down astray a bad way. And to your point, it all leads from the head coach at the top and the trickle-down effect from there. But you even mentioned about reading the books too. Is that something that you give them the books and say, this is something I wanted to be done by? Or is this just if you want to listen to this? Because I remember even at San Antonio Spurs, Greg Popovich, that was always something that he would always do, was give his team books and be more teaching them about culture and like outside of basketball things. Now, granted, those kids, I guess prep schools too, they're all from across the world. So you're learning about different cultures. But is that something, how does that work, the book, with you guys?
They hear that messaging quite a bit. Like a great quote I heard was like, not every reader is a leader, but every leader is a reader, right? So they hear those type of things from me all the time. And then I'm constantly referencing information that I get from different sources. So that every kid in my program definitely has heard the Captain Class. They've heard Mind Gym. Every assistant coach has heard The Score Takes Care of Itself. They've heard Legacy. Man. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. These are like foundational books that should be in people's bookshelf. So they've heard that stuff from me before, and everything in our programs that I've run, everything's voluntary. I don't really care if they come to games. This isn't my dream, it's their dream. But there's all these things that get offered. There's all these micro actions, and I want to see who takes advantage of what. If I made things mandatory, I wouldn't know where the passion lies and where the holes are and things like that and where the conversations can happen. So if I gave everybody a book, I don't know if they're going to read it. I don't know if they're interested. But if kids come to me and be like, hey, what was that book you said? Now I have something I could really pour into that kid more. I used to do that. Like, I think The Inner Game of Tennis we gave to a bunch of kids, but only 1 year did we give everybody Mind Gym. That was the one book 1 year we did it. And those kids would carry it in their pocket. But I haven't done it overall like that, where we just mandatory give out books. But we offer a lot.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I love that. I think we actually touched with Jackson about this, because what that Jackson Johnson, for those listening, who's the head coach at Newman School, we had on recently. But we talked about how you guys, because you create this voluntary willingness, then the willingness ultimately builds ownership, right? We were joking with the example that they give you the egg in science class. You got to carry the egg around and nurture it until it's time to hatch or whatever it is, or just any type of project that you have to be in charge of. And what's nice about what you guys do is they become their own project, and they have to pour into themselves. They got to water their own garden. They got to make sure that garden gets enough sunlight. It's on them. And typically when kids have that kind of healthy gun to their head to handle it on their own and take care of their own stuff, it'll get done if it's important enough. And then once they start to understand the benefits of that, they kind of get hooked and now they don't want to do it another way. And I think that's when you and coaches and your staffs really get a kind of corner smile on your face when you see that light click on and they start to, you're saying, okay, he gets it now.
Yeah. Cause at one point this was an experiment where I was like, let me just see if this would work. Right. And then you walk past the dining hall and they're all sitting together and they're talking about the academic index and the Ivy League and what classes they need to take and what grades they need to get and the SAT prep. And you're like, all right, that's working. And then you walk past them in the student center and they're talking about got to get enough sleep, got to recover, we got to work out in the morning. And they're all talking about plans and they're all, Krzyzewski talks about running to the standard. And then what happens is like the underclassmen start to chase the upperclassmen. And then when they leave it, now you have a new standard. And that's the type of stuff that happens in a voluntary environment. And I always challenge college coaches is like, they're like, how do you do this? And I explain it. And I'm like, all right, make your program voluntary and see who shows up. And then that will tell you about you. The question I always ask college coaches, would you play for you? What's happening in your program that if kids aren't showing up and they're not, if it's not voluntary, why not? So I'd want to know that question. Who would you want to play for you? And if the answer is yes, great. But who can play for you and who can't? When it's voluntary, you learn all that stuff. I don't like coming to individual workouts and here's why. I don't like coming to practice and here's why. And you can really like audit your program quite a bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Interesting. So that's how you hold, because I know you've been praised heavily for the academic success on top of the basketball success as well. But I know that was something that was huge. And it sounds like this is probably where a lot of it stems from, is holding the guys academically accountable, allowing them to, it sounds like a lot of them are holding the standard, carrying it forward and wanting to learn and grow on themselves. This kind of feed into the academic success that you guys have had as well then?
Yeah. People have high school kids sign contracts and that for me, that's just putting a ceiling on things, right? So they think it puts a floor in, and I don't agree with that. I think it puts a ceiling. Oh, here's my contract. I need to get a 2 point whatever, and they get a 2 point whatever. We have no contracts. We have no academic requirements, baselines. We don't have any of that. And because I don't want to discuss having conversations with kids and be like, okay, here's the range that you can succeed in, and this is the range that's acceptable. We don't do that. So I think academically, I've never put in a standard. It's just like, what's your best? We, at my previous school, we would give letter grades and number grades. I was way more concerned about the number grade than I was the letter grade. I'd get 1 through 5, 1 being the best, 5 being the worst in terms of effort. I'd get kids who had A2s and I'd have kids who get B, and I'd be really pumped about for the kid with a B1 and I'd question the kid who had an A2. Because it really isn't about the achievement. And if you're putting numbers on it, like, hey, 2.9, 3.3 is successful, then that's a whole different thing. I don't want to do that. So I'm more interested in their best self and all that in every aspect, including the academics.
Yeah, for sure. No, because God bless them. Some guys on their best day, it is a 2.75. That's just, again, genetics, whatever gifts they have, that's their max. And when they're laying it all on the line, that's what they're going to get versus, like you said, a really gifted guy that's getting a 2.75 and he should be at a 3.98. You're like, oh, wait a minute. What's going on with this gap? That's 1.2 points worth of an effort that you're not giving up.
We had a kid who was committed to an Ivy League school and he had a 36 on the ACT. Be in class and the admission office from Yale called this kid up and was like, hey, you got to be in class. What's happening? Are you matching your ability? And the kid was like, no, I'm not. And then the kid quickly turned it around and achieved in the class relative to his ability, just to further your point. So as kids are meeting their ability and the opportunity to match their potential, I'm good.
Yeah. No, I love it, man. I love it.
And that kind of gives the things I feel like too, because you're not forcing these kids to do it. They're doing it on their own. And if they see themselves starting to drop, it's you're doing this yourself. You don't have that. I like that a lot. It's interesting. Interesting.
And I think what's great about it, Coach, is you've had enough guys. There was a point, and who knows what year, whenever that point was, where you've had enough guys be successful and you've kind of had that really screwed into your program in terms of this is how we're doing it. Then you have enough guys kind of pass through and carry on and have success. Then that culture, and again, not to beat up the word culture, but just that way, the way you guys do things, it's speaking for itself after a while. You're talking less about it and you're letting the evidence do all the talking after a while. Yeah. Now, you probably had to do a lot of talking in the beginning just to lay the foundation for it. But there's a point where this thing really hit and all you got to do now is just look at the evidence. And then some kids and parents that want to be a part of that choose to. And again, the ones that didn't, it's not for everybody because nor should it be. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably, I just think
probably helped you. I hate to use the word weed out, but it kind of really helped you recruit itself. The setting kind of really helped you find who you wanted.
Yeah. We had a right of refusal from our players because they know the kids oftentimes better than I do. And if I brought a kid to campus and they were like, no, he won't fit. That was it. I didn't push back and be like, what do you mean? I like the kid. And they're like, no, he won't fit. Yeah. There was definitely that stuff for sure. Where we would just, you know, and then there's a few things that have happened where I remember the first time I walked into a room and there was acknowledgement that I walked into the room. I was like, oh, this is weird. My career has kind of changed a little bit. And the biggest one was I used to get daps all the time. Right. So like everybody dapped me up. And then in 2013, I started getting handshakes and I'm like, yo, what's going on here?
Right.
Where are these handshakes coming from? So like there is that evolution that happens where things that you're doing start to work and it start getting recognized, things like that. And then there is that self weeding out process. Well, you know, and but really you want to get to a place where in recruiting, especially where if you ask for nothing, you get everything. And I was really asking for something specific. And then the players that play for me, like, oh, that's a guy who could play for JC. And then those coaches, AU, college, whatever, would refer people to us. So there were a few things that kind of happened along the way where it was like, okay, I think this is working and this has legs and it's got some gravity to it. But yeah, I think the kids really makes the biggest difference where they can like say, this kid fits, this kid doesn't fit. And now as much as you can make a program player led, it makes a difference.
Yes, sir. No doubt about it.
No.
So you give, it sounds like your players a lot of opportunity to speak their voices and allow their voices to be heard in the program. But then you were saying like with the recruiting side and building a culture, you hold everybody to one specific standard, right? And or what you're looking to grow for. And then you mold around that. Talk about like how you have implemented this, at least from the beginning, like the first year Coach Carroll takes over as a head coach, wherever you want to talk on in particular, but just the first year, like how do you develop that? Because at one point you start to see, okay, this is working, but before it worked and before you knew it was working, like how do you implement that? You just hold all the players to a certain standard?
Yeah. So the first thing I do is I want to get aligned with the school and the university. You can't run UNLV's program at Harvard and you can't run Harvard's program at somewhere else. You know what I mean? Like, you got to get aligned. So with the Newman School, for example, visited the school, walked around, got to know some of the kids. And I was like, okay, they have really nice kids here. It was extraordinary to see how kind they were to each other. I couldn't tell a click. Every kid was hanging out with every kid. They were all in one pack. And I was like, okay, can't sacrifice character here. And not only can we not sacrifice it, we got to make sure we got great kids. You got to align with the school. So academically, it's a terrific school. Socially, super nice kids. And then they were really letting us run on terms of the basketball. So that's the first thing is I want to make sure that what you're trying to accomplish aligns with that school. And I think that sometimes gets missed, especially at the college level, with they just kind of on the outside, like, this is my program. It's like, all right, what about the school though? These kids have to be members of your community. They have to be in classes. They have to be those stuff. And I think that gets missed. So the first thing is that. And that really guided us in terms of who we could recruit because they had to fit that piece. So we would take tours and they'd have us, Newman's right in the middle of Boston. So it's a very urban school. And you'd see kids have a visceral response to a group of teenagers outside the library and what kind of reaction did they have. It's a place where you can have a lot of independence and they have to be able to manage that independence. So you got to make sure that the kids are mature enough to handle it or have the capacity to handle it. There's a lot of things like that, but the first thing is really absolutely making sure that you are aligned with the school's mission and that you have a basketball program that is aligned with all that. So that's first for sure.
Yeah. No, I love that, coach. It's funny. I tell every young head coach that's preparing to be a head coach to put this, I won't say demand, but put this request into their interview that in the first anywhere from 30 to 60 days, if they do get that job, that they would love to have a sit down with the athletic director and the school's president. And that could be a lunch, that could be in a meeting room in a hotel, a ballroom where you everybody brings some gadgets and you hook up some, show some video or whatever it is, but just getting aligned. And the overriding question for this meeting is one thing: what does success look like for the three of us?
Yeah.
And so now when a coach comes in and he's rebuilding and he hits a tough spot during this, that year one, and three starters are out with injuries and you lose six out of seven, everybody's referring back to that meeting and being able to say, okay, hey, we know what we're trying to do. We're going to keep building. We're going to stay patient. And you can call it the OKC formula, or you could call it, again, the Spurs rebuild has had that, where you're going to have some tough times. But everybody in the building, especially coach, administration, leadership, are all saying the same thing. So the fact that you said that for your level alone is important. But I think coaches that eventually want to be head coaches have got to be ready to have that conversation, whether it's in the interview or if they do get the job. That's got to be one of the things right up front, because you're doing that for when times are tough. When times are going great, everybody, it's easy to all be singing like the Temptations, but you got to be singing like the Temptations during tough times too.
Yeah. And I worked in the admission office for 14 years. And like, my thing was everyone had to be selling the school the same way. You had to be, we all had to be aligned. So I would just, I agree with everything you said. And I would add, I would sit with six or seven, five or six, depending on the size of the school, admission counselors, and be like, sell me the school. Tell me what the school is all about. Describe it. I'm a family from New York City. I'm a family from Omaha. I'm a family from LA. Sell me the school. And I want to hear that they're aligned in how they present this school, because that's important. If the admission office has eight different admission counselors selling eight different things, who are you? You know what I mean? So I want to know that. Sell it to me. I want to hear what the school, what are the best things, where the weaknesses are, like, sell it to me, because I want to see that alignment.
So make sure, noted, all of your assistants as well as yourself are selling the program the same, and then go in and talk with the admissions early on. Make sure they're selling it the same way. There you go. I know Mage always says about bringing donuts into the admissions office when you first get into for a new coaching position. So that's right there. That's a great way to segue that's, and at least get to introduce all them.
That's one of the stops. Admissions, financial aid, housing, president's office.
That's right.
I worked in admissions for 2 years. If somebody would have brought me donuts, I would have been, all right, I'm in. Let's do it.
You're a new head coach, man. You got to hit those four places, because that it just says something about what you're trying to do. You're not just there to try to win games. You're here to try to connect with people, and you're trying to show them what you're about. You're trying to show them, the people that are part of your program, what we're going to be about. And you're showing them that you want to be first, right? You're not waiting in your office for everybody to come and by your door and, hey, coach, welcome. Good to see you. No, you go be first. You go see people first. And the message that sends just changes everything. So
now let me ask this. So everything that we have discussed in the last, 30 minutes or so, not one thing has anything to do with basketball in the terms of on the court, right? I firmly believe this, because the coaches that I have had all are very similar to what you do. Everything off the court relays onto the court in an essence. Do you feel all of this off the court stuff is what has helped you be so instrumental on the court throughout the years?
Yeah, it's all connected, 100%. How you communicate. One of my assistant coaches, Cam Crocker, who's at Illinois now, he asked me, how do you come up with these halftime speeches? And it's, if it's true to me and true to them, I say it. And if you say we're not rebounding and Joe's in the corner like, I'm rebounding, you can't say it. If you're going to say something that's not collective, you got to use a person's name and be like, look, you're not rebounding. But if you say things like, we're not rebounding, we're not doing this, you're going to lose the room. So everything I say at halftime and is true to me, true to them. But that's everywhere. That if you lose credibility off the court, you don't have credibility on the court. And so, yes, it's all connected. So 100%.
That's funny. I don't know if you saw that Miles Turner's article, and it was frustrating to see it, but he was talking about what had happened in Milwaukee with Doc Rivers. And he talked about guys coming late, and then he didn't find everybody. Because I've seen the NBA, you're not going to bringing a guy in at 6 a.m. and doing burpees in the weight room for being late. They go right to your pocketbook at that level. But it was just frustrating to read that it had gotten to that point because, again, it clearly affected the way the Bucks played, right? Yep. They clearly had enough talent to be a playoff team. And it just makes so much sense that you say that. But you're right. There is a connection. Habits are habits. And it's the care about habits. The care is what carries over, right? Because the habits are that those are huge as well. But like the willingness to want to make sure this is important over here, then that same care and willingness is going to carry over to, yeah, let's hit this guy right on his numbers when he's coming off a screen. Don't let him, so he's not trying to reach down to his shoelaces or above his head for a catch and shoot. Let's put it spot on because that little thing matters just as much as all the other stuff. Leaving an opposing locker room cleaner than you found it.
Yeah, I think one of the best coaching moments I've ever seen was, and it was because of what he did off the court that he could do this. So Brad Stevens, they were having a preseason camp with the Celtics. They were down at Roger Williams. And Kyrie Irving threw like this really difficult lefty floater and he stopped practice and he brought him all over. And he just said, we don't shoot that shot here. And all the veterans just nodded their head yes. And Kyrie accepted that coaching. And it was because of what Brad did with Kyrie off the court that coaching was received well, because he wasn't like, oh, this coach just shows up for practice. He doesn't have any involvement in my life. And now he's telling me what to do. That would have been a whole different interaction where he'd be like, nah, screw that coach. I'm not listening to him. But because it was Brad Stevens, because of what he did off the court in that moment of coaching of, and it's another Brad Stevens thing. It's not what you say, it's what you accept. And we don't accept that here. And it was like setting a standard, and that coaching happened because of all the stuff that happened off the court.
And the ability to call out one of your star players and reprimand them and say, hey, this isn't, and he accepts it. That speaks volumes. And then everybody else feeds off of that too.
That's right.
Your point. Everybody eats, like everybody understands that. That's not something easy to do though. I feel like that's a hard thing that a lot of people don't understand is gaining the respect of the players. It's a lot harder to do. It definitely takes time being able to build that relationship. One thing that I will say, and I reference him a lot on here, but my high school coach, he always asks questions. Like, right, anytime you see him, how's mom? How's your family? How's everything going? He always asks questions. Whether he actually means it or not, I know he does, but he always asks questions. And that right there, every time he asks me these questions, every time I talk to him, those are the first three. How's your dog? How's your family? How's everybody going? That's the first three questions. How's everything else in your life? And it's like that just speaks volumes, because you can feel, even if, like I said, even if he's not genuine or not, you could feel it.
Yeah, I thought Bill Parcells said something where I make contact with every one of my players while they're stretching, right? And then like when you need to have that interaction, it's available because you've already had this foundation of connection. And I think that's really important to just make sure there's connections when it doesn't matter. Tech, quote unquote, doesn't matter. It always matters. But when it doesn't matter, so when you can do that kind of time coaching, it's been earned. You know what I mean? It's been received well and there's a relationship.
Yeah, no doubt. Would you agree, Coach, that in the landscape we're in now, that we actually, as coaches, regardless of what level we're on or gender, we really need to double down on that, just because the game has gotten transactional in many ways, which is not the player's fault. This is where we are, but they have more people now in their lives that want something, because we have players now more than ever that have something. And so we have to double down on being those people that don't want anything except their very best and their best well-being. And so I think we have to double down on that probably now more than ever, it seems.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think we're going through a transition process and there's all kinds of things that are pivoting, but at the core of everything is a relationship and that connection you have with a person, employee, husband, wife, kids, like whatever it is, the bottom line is, what's our level of connection? I think it's gotten a little wild, but it's going to settle down. But that when we come through it, everyone's going to just be like, oh, it's all foundational stuff. And that has to matter too.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah,
no doubt. I'm going to, before Doug asks him, I'm going to kind of go back to what I'm laughing as I say this, because it's a question that he brought up earlier, a statement he brought up earlier. What are some of your, and now as we just talked a little bit of basketball, what are some of your staples offensively and defensively? Just the things that over time, that just you know that they're battle tested, that you hold true and dear to your soul, that whenever you lay your head on the pillow after a game is played, win or lose, did we do these things on offense and defense? What are those things to John Carroll?
So the golden rule is no contested shots. We're too good oftentimes for anyone on our team to think that they're so important and they're so necessary that they could take a bad contested shot. So that's a golden rule. And what that does is, we've all played, when someone takes a contested shot, I'm just not going to run back on defense as hard. And the next time down the floor, I may look him off. And when I'm setting a screen, I may not set a screen for that guy as hard as I would another guy, because he's going to get it. He's going to take some bad shot. So the ripple effect of contested shots is a cancer in every way, shape, or form. And you watch it in the NBA, you watch it in WNBA, you watch college, high school, AAU especially. You watch this, what's accepted in terms of quality of shot. I heard Luke Murray use the expression shot diet. I love that expression. So no contested shots. In game, the stat that my sneaky stat that means a lot to me is how many assists per basket do we have? A high number is 60%, and I want that number to be 80%. I want to know that we're moving the ball and we're getting paint touches and we're kicking. And it gets back to the right decision or winning decision. And the right decision, sure, you took a tough shot and you made it. Yeah, that the ball went in. However, your teammate was open in the corner. He just hit four threes in a row. If you kick it to him, he could hit a three, and now he got 3 points instead of 2 points. That's a winning play. That sneaky stat often connects to winning plays, right? So I like that a lot too. And then we want the ball to really pop. I want to make sure kids are looking, catching, and acting rather than catching, looking, and acting. And I say it that way with that timing and that pattern for a reason. Look, catch, act. I want it to be quick rather than look, catch, act. So I want that to be the case too. And then we really don't want to, we call it purposeful dribbles. If you're dribbling with a purpose, you can do it. You catch the ball, you put it on the floor, and then you pass it. That's a turnover. So we really try to teach ball movement. So I can go on for offense. Like I said earlier, the best offense is offense.
It's offense.
I believe the best offense is a good defense.
Oh, I love that when you said that earlier, right?
Yeah, I don't believe in that. I believe the best offense is offense. And I'm more than happy winning 120 to 119. I don't really care about that. But to give defense, we give it about 8% of time in practice. And I'll give it 8% here. I just believe in the pack line defense at my level. I think this is really where prep school and AAU, a kid catches a ball in AAU and there's a gap. It's a big gap. And if you can put two players in the gap at my level, the guy catches it and he just doesn't know what to do when there's two players in help position. So the ball stays on the perimeter. So for me at the prep school level, I think the pack line is the best. And then on offense, I think the two guard is great. We're playing three games a week and three practices, and good luck scouting us when we have 50 quick hitters, and you got to teach your players that within a day, maybe 2 days of prep. So I think those are the two sweet spots for me in prep school, is the two guard offense and all the action they have. And then the back line, really tough to beat.
But two guard meaning John Beilein's, like the two guard front, hit the wing, first cutter, second cutter, that type.
Yeah. All that action. Yeah. There's zillions of it. And we've evolved with it, not away from it, because we still do it. But there's all kinds of sets, but I like that front, that disguising the front of the two guard, where it's like you can just do anything out of it. So I think it's when teams have different formations, you can kind of scout it a little easier before the play gets running. In the two guard formation, you can't really scout it until the second or third action. The ball, the cut off the screen, the pass to the wing. Now you get a live scout that. That's really hard to do, especially in prep school.
Yeah, I love that you said that. Sean McVay talked about that's why the Rams, and he has Matt Stafford go under center. And almost the Rams are almost rarely, if ever, maybe they're playing catch up, but they're rarely in shotgun.
Yeah.
And he said it just for that reason, because what's shotgun? Nine times out of 10, the guy's throwing it.
Yeah.
Whereas some quarterbacks, nine times out of 10 under center, it's going to be a handoff. Mm-hmm. Versus let's just put Matt Stafford under center all the time. And then it could be run, could be handoff, could be bootleg, could be sprint draw, whatever. So,
yeah, I love that.
I like, yes. My bad, Doug, but he made me think of that NFL analogy there.
No, I was going to say you said 50 quick hitters. Now, I know a lot of times it might be difficult for some teams to even remember 10. So I'm assuming the academic portion off the floor leads into you guys being able to understand and remember, especially if you're sending kids to the Ivy League. It's a little probably easier for you to implement these.
Yeah, you have no idea. We use the military alphabet, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta. And then if we play a team a second time, we'll use a city. And then we play them a third time, we'll use fruit. So Alpha becomes Apple becomes Albany. And yeah, we get into it. We get in the weeds.
What's great about what you're saying, though, Coach, is like when you have a base system,
yeah,
it's actually easier because you're not making them remember a lot of different alignments, right? Mm-hmm. The alignment stays the same. And then the wrinkles. Yeah. So then your wrinkles have wrinkles.
That's right.
And then your wrinkles that have wrinkles.
That's right.
But it's all coming out of this similar alignment. So yeah. When you can, and then when you attach a word to it or a phrase to it, then they kind of know if Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, if Charlie is a flare screen, then anything you say involving Charlie, they know it's going to have a flare screen in it.
Yeah. Yeah. We get into that. We're like cross pitch, Alpha, Charlie. They call it out like that. Like it's a football game. But I think I have taken a bunch of stuff from Bayline because he coached Spike Albrecht and I went through a bunch of his stuff and I saw a lot of commonality. And what he got to was the plays and the actions now had players' names attached to it because they had success. So one of our actions, we call it Ben for Ben Callahan Gold. There's another one we call Andrew Playtech for Playtech that played in North Carolina. So that's where like the really cool part where the action becomes we're honoring the previous guy who came before and we give him the play and the action. And like now all the kids want to learn plays and get good at it so they can actually own
it. They want one too. I mean?
Get your own.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Wow, that's awesome.
For sure.
You guys have been doing what you're doing for so long. So it's good. We appreciate you lifting the hood on that just for a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Hopefully we didn't out you for people being able to scout you now moving forward.
No, they got no chance. Nobody's remembered cross pitch, Charlie Alpha, Delta. Yeah, good luck with that.
We change the names every year too, so good luck.
Okay, good. I feel better now. That's impressive, though. There's a wide range of ways that you can do it. I've seen coaches even have baseball play calls too, right? That's just right. Like tug the ear, touch the nose, whatever. So it's cool to see different ways and different techniques that people use. It is interesting. I would have never thought of different variations of using the word A, Alpha, Apple, and then Omega, Orange, and going down the line. That's interesting, though. That's cool.
Yeah, it's funny because like Jason Smith, who I'm with over at Masters, like he would – when he had return teams that were returning, he'd be like, it's last year's Bravo. He was like, have the scout down where he would reference last year's call. He was really good at it.
And the kids probably have no idea what that is, though. Last year's Bravo, I have probably no idea. That's awesome. That's
hilarious. Yeah, we actually have been – I've lost touch with him. I've been trying to get we chatted a little bit last year, but would love to get Jason on as well.
Yeah, no, he's great.
Talk about sustained success,
I think he's been given less credit as a coach as I think he deserves. I think he's the best coach in the country and everyone's his teams are really good. Yeah, it's hard to do that. I think he's gotten so much better as a coach over the years, and I do think he's the best coach in the country. It'd be great to have him on here.
Yeah, we'd love it.
Yeah,
Coach, first off, on the floor, off the floor, everything that you have given us advice wise honestly has been absolutely phenomenal. There's been some great stuff for the basketball architect to come out here and speak it himself, we're definitely learning a lot. I could say
He laid the blueprint on the table, that's for sure.
Laid the blueprint. He's over here looking. Yep. Beautiful. Now, there is one final question I do want to throw out just for any advice for people who are looking to move up in the profession, right? Like I said, I know you've been on the head coaching side. You've worked your way up in a variety of different areas and roles. You've been on the athletic director side as well. The best advice you would give your younger self starting in the industry, what would that be?
It was what I learned myself. So I think to cut corners here, I read Rick Pitino's book, 24-Hour Contract. Like it's a 100-page book, but really all I took out of it was 24-Hour Contract. That concept is awesome. Did you do enough today to earn a job or earn a contract for tomorrow? And I just love that. But the book, I didn't need the book. And I just think finding out the people and the things that work for you. So like for me, getting in the room with Steve Donahue, Lenny Acuff, and Dave Foucher, when they were doing their two guard chalk talk in 2009, was turned out to be probably the most important conversation I had. And just be around, be available. Try not to put your square peg in a round hole. Just try and be around as much as you can and see where your round peg and fits into what round hole, rather than just saying, I just want to get to this person because this person's famous or had success. That may not work for you. So I think really study people, but study yourself. And for me, for example, I would have been miserable, as great as Joey Gallo is at his zone defense, I would have lost my mind doing a zone defense. This is not for me. I'm a man guy.
That's right.
So like, Joey's the best.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I worked my previous head coach at Chatham was his assistant, and we implemented that at Chatham for a little bit. And it was tough to teach. So yeah. To be able to learn it, it's definitely difficult.
Yeah, so what he does, it looks like a Broadway show. The choreography is insane. It's unbelievable, but it's just not for me. So I think that would be the first thing, is really know yourself and where you want to get better at you, right? So that'd be first. And then whatever level you want to get to it. So if you want to be a Division I coach, get to it. And it's going to be a sacrifice no matter what. You're not going to get paid early on. You're not going to be happy with the work you're doing, but get into the level that you want to get to. So if you want to be a D1 coach, NBA coach, D2, prep school, just get in it.
No, I love it, man. Coach, before Dougie lands the plane, listen, we're at about 2, maybe 80 of these in approaching almost 3 years. And I got to tell you, from just the meat and potatoes stuff that coaches need to hear, all levels, just the ABC 1, 2, 3 of just getting players to own their own process. As Pat Riley said it, you have to be an active participant in your own rescue.
That's right.
And so you have done that as well as anybody has ever laid it out. And literally, from a blueprint perspective, not to beat up the architect thing, but literally, you've given people a blueprint on how to get kids to embrace their own ownership in terms of handling their stuff. And it's as good as anyone has ever stated it and laid it out. And we can't thank you enough for jumping on here, man.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, coach, and I'll just throw in, everybody always says to play for the name across the front of your chest, not the one on the back. I was playing for yours for 4 years. So yeah.
Didn't even know it. Didn't even know what he was doing.
This is the conversation I needed to have.
I love it. Play for the name on the front of the jersey. I love that.
Yeah. So thank you for my great experiences. Again, I want to make sure. But yeah. Also, honestly, thank you just for hopping on here. Like, again, I know you've done a wide range of things in the industry, and it obviously is great for people to be able to hear your side, the development side, the off the court, the on the court again. So,
oh man,
thank you. Thank you.
So good.
And thank you to Jackson for hooking us up. Got to make sure to say that.
I will, for sure.
Yeah. No. And everybody out there tuning in, I'm sure you came away with some great information, but thank you all for chiming in and listening to another episode. The Rising Coaches Podcast, your host, Al Major, Doug Caputo. Coaches, keep working, keep rising. Have a good one. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together. We'll be right back.
Coach, are you still hanging on to that old shooting machine that's just sitting in storage and not getting used at all? Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help trade in your machine. Any make, any model, in any condition, even if it's from a competitor. Plus, you get an extra $250 off the Dr. Dish commercial lineup when you mention Rising Coaches.